Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the first lecture of the year 2000 and what may be a new century and a new millennium. It is, I believe, the 84th season of the Vancouver Institute that is now starting. And during this spring session, any of you who read the program will know, there will be a quite eclectic, I think very interesting, variety of speakers. To those of you who are not members, I am asked to say, as we often do, please consider becoming members. It's a modest contribution to make, $30 for a family for the year, $20 for an adult, single adult, and $10 for a student, and I'm told it's tax deductible. It's my very great pleasure tonight to introduce to you Professor Brett Finley. He is a native of Alberta, grew up there, attended the University of Alberta, where he received his Bachelor of Science in 1981 and his PhD in 1986. He spent 3 years as a postdoctorate research fellow at Stanford, and then came to this university in 1989 as an assistant professor in the Department of Biotechnology, Biochemistry, and Molecular Biology. He is, according to all the reliable information I've received, one of the rising stars of research in his field, and has been the recipient of many honors. There are some details of that in your program, and I will not keep you back from hearing from him any longer. Professor Finley.
Thank you. Well, tonight I want to go into the invisible world, the world of microbes. And so, and this talk's going to be divided sort of into two halves. The first half will be microbes and what they do in our world, how they cause disease, how we fight them, and try and battle them. And then the second half, I'm going to tell you a little bit about how some of these little devils do their deeds. That is, how they might cause diarrhea and things like that. And it'll be at a cursory level, but I think I want to give you sort of a flavor of what we think about on a daily basis. We have a saying in our lab that diarrhea is our bread and butter, and I think you'll see why after we're done this tonight. So to introduce you to this sort of invisible world is that microbes are small. These things are invisible. But just because you can't see them doesn't mean they're not there. And just to give an example of the size, a bacterium is about 1/1000th of a millimeter. So if you think of the ruler and you have 1 millimeter on it, you could take 1,000 bacteria and line them up end to end, and that would make 1 millimeter. You can't see them. And just to put things in perspective, if we have our lovely microbe here, this entire room would be about 1 mammalian cell. So they're everywhere, but they're very, very tiny. We can't normally see them. So I look in the room, I ask you, are you man or are you microbe? Or shall I say person or microbe? And I know what most of you would say, but I would argue that wrong. There's actually 10 times more bacteria on or in us than there are mammalian cells in us. And I know the number is 10 to 1. And I think another graphic illustration of how many they are is 1 gram of feces contains greater than 1 billion bacteria. So they're everywhere, and there's lots of them. They're all over us. Hair, skin, mouth, mucous membranes, everywhere. They're even in our gastrointestinal tract, which is not really inside of us. It's sort of a tube that goes through us. So they're found in there. They're not found deep inside of us. Blood, tissue, things like that, that's usually sterile. And microbes are not normally found there. Well, what do these things do for us? Well, they do lots of things, normally, and they're actually involved in our day-to-day life much more than we realize. For example, inside the intestine, when you eat, there's a bunch of bacteria in there that are going to chew on that food and break it down, which aids in our digestion of it. They supply some nutrients, some vitamins, and things like that. And we can then pick them up, the microbes make, and use that for our own use. And important for this talk is they actually protect against the incoming pathogens. So if there's a pathogen that's coming in, and it's going to hit this layer of normal flora that aren't doing anything, it's going to bounce off and not be able to land. And that actually serves as sort of a protection for us. So they play a large role in that. Well, just to give an example of showing you that they're everywhere, I was on sabbatical last year, so one of the things I did was take a toothpick in the lab, scraped my inside of my cheek, put it on a slide, and then stayed in that slide, and that's what's showing up here. This is one cell, this is my cheek cell, right here. This is the nucleus, and if you look closely, you see all these little, sort of these two little dots all over the place and these single little spots. Each of those is a single bacterium. I brushed my teeth before I did this experiment. This is normal. We all have many, many microbes in our mouth, and they happily live there and usually don't cause any problems. Well, a major capacity that microbes have is to grow fast. We double in what, 20 years? Microbes do it in 20 minutes. And that gives them a major, major advantage. And over on the this one, I'll show you just a picture of a E. coli, standard lab strain E. coli, that grows. Two goes to four, goes to eight, goes to 16, 24. Yikes. So if you think about it, if they divide in 20 minutes, that's 2^72 bacteria every 24 hours. The question is, why are we sitting here? Why aren't we just buried in a sea of microbes? Well, that's unlimited growth. If you take bacteria inside our gut, it's actually, they're in a fierce competition, and they're fighting each other for nutrients. And inside the gut, they only divide about once every 24 hours. But I want you to remember this concept of growing fast, because that becomes a major element in a bacteria able to evolve fast. And as we'll see, that has major consequences in what they do. So I want to talk about infectious diseases, mainly bacterial diseases, and just to give you an idea of the magnitude of the problem. Sometimes in society we're misled in saying that infectious diseases aren't that big a problem. Well, they are. They're the leading cause of death worldwide. About 1/3 of the world's population dies every year due to infectious diseases, 17 million people per year. That leads heart disease and cancer and other things like that. And in our society, infectious diseases are the third leading cause of death. 20%, 1/5 of everyone in our society still dies of infectious diseases. So they play a major role. They're also the leading cause of lost productivity. And it's thought that infectious diseases cost the US, $120 billion per year in terms of just healthcare costs and things like that. So big, big problem. Well, I want to talk about disease. Think about the word dis-ease. It's a great word when you think about it because it sort of means maladies, unease. And it tells you something's wrong. And what disease really is sort of a presentation of a battle between a pathogen and us that's gone in the pathogen's favor, and it gives us symptoms, being sort of redness, swelling, pain, things like that. So most pathogens come in, they actually don't have any effect on us. They come in, they glance out, and they go out again. That's sort of the normal case. Once in a while, the pathogen's able to establish a foothold and do its thing, and then we have disease, which is the upset of the normal equilibrium in us. Microbes have played a major role in our history. Just to give you some sort of tidbits, more people died in the Civil War due to infections and bullet wounds. The 1918 flu pandemic killed more people than all the people that died in World War I. And Black Death, bubonic plague, killed a third of Europe in the Dark Ages. And thanks to that, that's probably one of the main reasons why we call it the Dark Ages, because of the large mortality associated with it. Now, when you think about bacterial diseases, there are many, many different kinds, and there's a wide range of diseases. And up here, I've listed some of the ones that we hear about, and this is just a random listing. I just listed a few I thought about once in a while. And you can see that they range from rather non-life-threatening things, such as acne. Maybe it's life-threatening if you have a heavy date Saturday night, but it's not usually a problem. And dental cavities, teeth cavities, caries. This is actually the leading cause of infections worldwide. Many people have teeth cavities. And that's caused by many different kinds of bacteria, about 300 bacteria. We can only grow a handful of the ones in our mouth. They have very peculiar growing requirements, but remains a big cause. And you can go through all the ones we've heard lots about. Let's stop at tuberculosis. This is the single most deadly bacterial agent. Kills about 1 million people per year worldwide. About a third of the world carries TB. And it's very prevalent, very deadly, and still a major problem both here and throughout the world. It's seen a big resurgence because it's become multi-drug resistant, meaning it's much more difficult to treat, and it's because causing big, big problems. Here's another one I want to talk about a little bit, ulcers. And for a long time, it was thought that ulcers were due to stress, hard work, overwork, and things like that. In the early 1980s, this rather strange Australian, who was a gastroenterologist, was convinced that ulcers were actually bacterial in nature. And you tell that to someone at that time, they'd laugh. I mean, that was not true. Well, this guy wouldn't take no for an answer, and he went on to culture the organisms out of the stomachs that he always saw. He then did the ultimate experiment. He drank the stuff, gave himself an ulcer, and then cured it with an antibiotic. And people started to really take notice. Then two more even crazier New Zealanders repeated the experiment, but they couldn't get rid of the ulcers with the antibiotics, because ulcers are sometimes harder to treat with antibiotics. We now know for sure ulcers are caused by a bacterium, something called Helicobacter pylorum. And they actually infect about half the world's population. Big problems there. And the other thing is, ulcers are one thing, but that same bacterium is actually very closely associated with stomach cancer. And we now know that many of our stomach cancers are due to this bacteria. And it's the only bacterium so far that's actually classed as a class 1 carcinogen, which is the same class as a cigarette. Now, we haven't exhausted all the bacterial diseases we can identify to bacterial origin, and we're constantly realizing that some diseases we didn't think were bacteria actually are. And the ulcer lesson was a big lesson, and there's now data starting to occur that things like atherosclerosis is probably of bacterial origin. Other diseases, such as inflammatory bowel disease, is probably bacterial origin. We're still proving it, and time will tell whether it is or not, but I think that we will see more and more diseases being attributed to microbes that we didn't quite realize before. Well, if you're going to be an infectious agent, you want to be able to get around. And you want to spread to things. And the other thing to remember is that there's actually quite good ways of getting around this world. You can go orally, fecally, fecal-oral, oral-fecal. You can go in the water, air, food. Pathogens choose all these different ways to get around their world. And the really scary thing is that we really do live in a small world. And just to illustrate how small that is, this is a true story. 1994, woman with multi-drug-resistant fulminant tuberculosis got on an airplane in Chicago and flew to Miami. 9-hour flight, coughed, hacked, made sputum, standard tuberculosis type things. Well, turns out when they realized this, they went back and tested all the passengers. And each one of these yellow dots on this airplane represents someone who's seroconverted, meaning they were exposed to tuberculosis and could potentially have tuberculosis. So think about that as we're all sitting there coughing on each other in this audience, as you jump on a crowded bus, places like this. Actually, airplanes are pretty safe. They do a really good job. They actually filter the air and they cook it and do all these other things to it. So I don't want to scare you, and this is actually a rather unusual case, but it does happen. The finale of the story is, unfortunately, this person died of the tuberculosis, and I don't know, they never followed up what happened with the other people. Presumably because they knew they were exposed, they could then treat it. Okay, well, infectious diseases are everywhere. They're constantly causing problems. How do we grapple with these? What do we do? We have two main weapons, antibiotics and vaccines. These are the traditional ones, and these are the ones that we've been using to treat infectious diseases. They work differently. Antibiotics kill bacteria. They are small chemical compounds that will go in and kill bacteria. They don't just kill pathogens. They kill the normal flora, too. And if you remember, I said the normal flora forms a protective barrier. When you take antibiotics, you're getting rid of that protective barrier and setting yourself up for something else as well. You use antibiotics once you detect an infection. You have an infection, you go to the doctor, you ask for an antibiotic. It's there, and you want to kill the things that are doing it. Vaccines are preventative medicine, which is a different concept. You may or may not eventually be exposed to that disease, but you want to have a vaccine just in case you do hit it. And so that's a very different concept. When vaccines work, they work beautifully. They're much better. They're preventative, they're cheaper, they're easier, and they're generally more effective than antibiotics. But you wouldn't vaccinate someone once a person presented with disease. At least in most cases, that's not usually how it's done. Well, let's talk about antibiotics. Major, major discovery, and if someone asks me what's one of the biggest things we've discovered this century, I would argue antibiotics. This has changed our whole lifestyle, and for if any of you were around, or if you weren't, go ask someone that was. I think they will tell you what it was like going from a pre-antibiotic era to where you could actually treat infections, normally killed people, and they were relatively harmless. So, one of the first antibiotics, one that you probably are all aware of, is something called penicillin. This is its chemical structure here. And this was discovered in the 40s. The sulfonamides were actually discovered before it. But all these small chemical compounds, these antibiotics, they actually work by blocking a particular process that's in the bacteria that's not in us, or at least is different enough so that it doesn't sort of cross-react and cause toxic problems with us. And so these various bacterial processes are numerous, and there's several places that we can develop antibiotics to. And if we have a picture of bacterium here, it's got many cellular processes, such as making DNA into RNA to making proteins. And the machinery the bacteria use is different enough than the machinery we use so that you can develop compounds that will actually poison these different steps, and then block it. They can poke holes in the bacteria, penicillin, and they can do other things to it that will stop the organism from growing. So these are the way antibiotics work. They basically poison the organisms. So here we're going to see a video of E. coli being blown up by penicillin. So what we've done is taken E. coli. And you'll see E. coli here, just, is this moving? Okay, and it's growing along very slowly. Watch this guy here. You're going to see a balloon come out, and then you're going to see it go. That's the penicillin blowing it apart. If you don't believe me, watch. Poor guys, hey? What'd you do for a movie? This is penicillin, this is what it does. You can imagine, you see these balloons go out, and then they're history. Oh, it's a sad sight. Breaks my heart. Okay. Well, as I said, antibiotics, these were truly wonder drugs. This changed just so many different things. They worked really, really well against bacteria. Antibiotics do not work against viruses. That's because viruses use our machinery. So that's why it's really hard to get antiviral agents, because the viruses are so sneaky, they just use our own machinery, so you don't have nearly as many places to try and step in and make inhibitors to it. Well, in typical human nature, much like the unsinkable Titanic, 1969, there was a very unfortunate comet that really changed the way the research into infectious diseases went. And the US Surgeon General said to Congress, basically, it's done. Antibiotics no longer a problem. And as we all know, I just told you how many people die worldwide of infectious diseases, bacterial diseases, things like that. It doesn't work. Never say never to nature. And we all know now that antibiotics are not the end all the time. Well, what happened? We got antibiotic resistance. The bacteria figured out ways of avoiding these poisons so they would no longer be killed by it. And one of the main reasons they did this, and actually while I'm talking, I'm going to do a little experiment here. You guys could just take one piece of these paper and just pass them around randomly in this side, and you'll see what this is for when you get to it. Don't worry, this doesn't bite. Just grab a paper, just pass it around. Don't send it down the roll, send it just, I want it randomly. We'll talk about this in a second. So, the bacteria, because they divide so fast, they can evolve fast. Think how long it takes us to evolve when we only divide every 20 years. If you're doing it every 20 minutes, you can really turn it on and try different things. And, you know, if you got 10 to the 9th there, you know, so what? If 10 to the 8th die, you still got, you know, bacteria around. Well, there's three real big reasons why we have antibiotic resistance. So I want someone, whenever you get two pads, just to holler and stop me, or two colors, to tell me that you've got that, okay? So the three big reasons are, initially, physicians were to blame for a lot of this, because antibiotics, they worked great. And if someone comes in moaning and groaning, they were very happy when they went away with an antibiotic. And sometimes that person was moaning and groaning because of a viral infection. Antibiotics aren't going to work, and that really shouldn't be used. So that then provides a selective pressure to get resistance. Or you might say use a fourth generation cephalosporin when something as basic as penicillin will do, and so you then start resistances to that. Patient misuse and abuse of antibiotics is extreme, and this has been a big problem. In India, they take chloramphenicol one a day to keep the typhoid fever away. You imagine the Salmonella typhi is now chloramphenicol resistance there. Or you go to the doctor's office. Kid's got an ear infection. Doctor says, well, it's viral. You say, well, give me antibiotics anyway. Well, it's viral. It's not going to work. Well, okay, I'm going to another doctor, sort of thing. Or you get a box of pills, and it says take 10, take one per day for 10 days. You take them for 4 days, you feel great. Don't need to take this anymore. Bad move. Finish them. The reason they say to finish it is because if you don't, you're going to put a selective pressure for the few that survive. They will then live, and they can then become resistant to that. Well, that should generally, theoretically, be fairly simple, but it turns out that, say, you've got a streetless person with tuberculosis in the streets of East Vancouver. To treat TB, sometimes you have to take a pill a day for a year. You try and do that with a homeless person. I mean, you know, he's going to take it for a while. TB feels better. There's no way they're going to comply with that, and that's been a big problem. Now, the last area I want to talk about is agriculture. Over half of the antibiotics are dumped into animal feed. Things grow better initially because they take these things out, but relatively soon, what we often see is, say, a farmer presenting in the hospital with antibiotic-resistant organisms, the profile is exactly the same as the profile of what he was feeding his cattle, pigs, salmon, whatever it is. Because we dump all these tons into agriculture, these things can then become resistant to it, and this has been another major source of antibiotic resistance. Where do these things come from? How on earth do they become resistant to these things? Well, most people are now aware of the internet. I call this the genetic internet. Inside our gut, everywhere, these microbes have ways of basically downloading genetic information from each other, passing around, and sharing it. And antibiotic resistance is no different. And if you have a piece of DNA that encodes an antibiotic resistance, you can then basically download the file, grab it from your neighbor, and get it. And that's what this next animation is going to show. We have two bacteria. This bacteria, the one on the left, you see this red circle here, that's a piece of DNA that encodes an antibiotic resistance. What it's going to do, and that resistance is represented by, say, these yellow things on the bacterial surface, what it can do is pass this resistance over to this strain, which is not resistant, give it to it, say, here you go. Now you can be antibiotic resistant. You can sprout these yellow things. And then you will now be both antibiotic resistant. Just like downloading a file off the net, you pass it around. Once that person has it, or that bacteria has it, it can then pass along and along and along. That's exactly what's happening inside our guts right now. This is a very normal process. So let's start this again. They form an appendage, basically a bridge. There goes the copy of DNA over, sprouts these proteins here. We now have an antibiotic resistant strain. Thank you. Okay, just hang on. We'll get to that in the next slide. We're not playing bingo. Okay, so, oh yeah, one more. I want to talk about superbugs. We all hear about this in the press. The press loves that term. It's a great term, superbugs. Superbugs and flesh-eating bacteria have to be the press's major contribution to infectious diseases. So let's talk, what is a superbug? A superbug is what the press has named as an organism that is resistant to many antibiotics. And the two we're going to talk about are the two the press generally calls the superbugs, something called methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, or MRSA, and vancomycin-resistant Enterococcus. Green is Enterococcus, and this is an organism that doesn't really affect normal people. If you're very sick, it can cause some problems, very serious problems. And it turns out that VRE is resistant to vancomycin plus every other antibiotic you can use on it. So you can't treat it. This is a bacterial infection you can't treat. That's why it's extremely a problem if you get it, because you cannot treat it. Now, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus is an organism that affects everyone. It's always around here, and a lot of people carry it. And the only drug that you can treat MRSA with is vancomycin. So what happens if the vancomycin-resistant genes from this guy gets passed over to this Staph aureus, so you can't treat Staph aureus now? Staph aureus infections can be very serious, and if you look in the pre-antibiotic area, treatments included such things as radical surgery and things like that. This is precisely what has happened. Now, so those little pieces of paper I had, that was an example. Let's say that one represented the vancomycin resistance being passed around, and then the pink was the MRSA strain. So whoever won the bingo, you are now truly a superbug, because you've now acquired the resistance to basically every antibiotic we have. This has happened. 1996, it happened for the first time in Hong Kong. This results in a strain called VISA, vancomycin intermediate Staph aureus. This is a very scary strain because we cannot treat it. It's a bacterial infection, but we can't touch it. So it's just supportive care, and it's things like this. So this is happening. You can see it's happening like this. Just what every bacteria you look at, resistance has gone like this and just continues to spiral upwards. So for those of you that got those slips of paper, if you look on the bottom, there's a web address. If you want more information on this, and there's some other lectures and stuff, you can find it there. So you're the proud new owner of a pharmaceutical company, and your scientists have come in there and say, hey, look, we got the greatest thing. This thing will kill bacteria. Let's go make an antibiotic. This is what your prospects are. You're going to spend $200 million to develop it, get it through all the clinical trials and things like that. Big bucks. That's $200 million US, I should add. It's 10 years from the eureka at the bench to when you actually get that thing out to bedside. There's an amazing number of regulatory hoops you have to go through to get a drug approved. Look at this. 1 year after you've been extensively using this drug, you will see resistance to it. And 2 years, that's it. $200 million. So you can see why it's tough developing new antibiotics. And these are major issues that we have to consider when we develop these companies. What do we do? Well, for one thing, we have to treasure antibiotics. These are nature's greatest gift to us. We cannot be using them in cattle feed and people and using them just everywhere indiscriminately. When we get new antibiotics, we have to treasure them, use them only for what they're made for, use them to the full extent, so you use them until your prescription's up, and don't mix human and agriculture. And the other thing we need to do, and this is probably the hardest thing, is we have to do it worldwide. And just because we live in Canada doesn't mean that a healthcare policy over in Asia with drugs is not going to impact on us. It's only a 24-hour plane ride, and pretty well just about every common organism in Asia, all the pathogens over there, they're all multi-drug resistant. 98% of Salmonella typhi in India is MD, multi-drug resistant. And again, we see this. So we're going to face this too. So in an ideal world, we'd have some kind of global authority that could then control all this. Okay, let's turn to our other weapon we have and talk a little bit about vaccines. When a vaccine works, it usually works really well. Really, really well. And it's a very effective healthcare measure. As I said, it doesn't kill the pathogen. And because it doesn't kill the pathogen, you're not putting a selective pressure on it. So you see less resistance to vaccines developing. It just says, you can't live in my nasopharynx, for example. You can live elsewhere. I'm not going to kill you, but you can't live there. Vaccines work by basically stimulating our own defenses, our own immune system, and says that when you see this pathogen coming, you can then jump on it, fight it, kill it, clear it. So we're doing the hard work. The vaccine just basically says, when you see that something looks like this, you can go after it. So it gets us primed for that. There's no guarantee that just because you're vaccinated something, you'll ever see that disease. Most of the things we get vaccinated for, we don't even see. But sort of a safety measure, it's kind of like an insurance policy, and it works very well. How do we make a vaccine? Well, basically, we either take a piece of a pathogen and immunize with it, so we're stimulated to that, or we take a pathogen and cripple it so it can affect us a little bit, but just enough to get an immune system going, but it can't actually cause disease. And we have vaccines of both of those types commonly used in all our day-to-day vaccines. As I've seen, vaccines are fairly common, they're effective, they're usually fairly cheap to produce, you can make lots of these proteins, fairly easy to administer usually. And an added benefit of vaccines is if 80% of you were vaccinated against something, that pathogen then comes wandering in, the odds are of it landing on a person that's vaccinated and they just dying because they can't go anywhere else are very good. If it landed on one of the 20% that weren't vaccinated, you would cough it or whatever, pass on to the next person. Again, you would hit another person and block that chain of infection. This is something we call herd immunity, and it works very well, that if most people are vaccinated, then it actually will then eliminate the transmission of it. Here's an ethical question. It's a tough one. What happens if, say, a vaccine has a 1 in a million chance of causing a seizure? Say, well, I don't want to give my kid that vaccine. There's 1 in a million chance of giving a seizure. But getting the disease, it's 1 in 300 chance of dying from it. This is exactly the dilemma that was faced with the whooping cough vaccine. And some people said, well, I'm not going to give my kid the vaccine. Yet they did that in the States. They quit giving the vaccine. Then we saw a resurgence in whooping cough and many unnecessary deaths. So from a society point of view, we really want to vaccinate. But there are some unfortunate incidents, and that then gets played up and leads to some big ethical problems. Well, here's a list of vaccines. The year I was born, the year high school students were born, and today they're available. We keep adding to that list, it gets getting longer, that gives us more and more vaccines to choose from. And this is a lovely red line. You no longer get vaccinated to smallpox because there is no more smallpox in this world. It's been eradicated. And within our lifetimes, we're also going to see polio no longer. It'll be eradicated, and there's a major movement upon that. And we're actually starting to make some major inroads on these diseases. So you can see that things, such simple diseases as chickenpox, and I guess this probably is where everyone in this room has had chickenpox, now you can have the option of vaccinating your kid so you don't get chickenpox. And when you talk to people as you go back, I mean, I had mumps. I mean, I remember these god-awful things on my neck that I couldn't eat my roast beef Sunday night. It really made me mad. Now you talk to kids, what's mumps, you know? That's not around. And again, the list continues to grow. How do we build a vaccine? Well, it's really hard to run into the lab and say, well, I'm going to do this. Rationally developing a vaccine is difficult. It's experimental, it's trial and error, and sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. One of the reasons it sometimes doesn't work is because these vaccines can change what they look like. They can put on a different coat every time they go out, and so if you're looking for a red coat and a green coat comes out, your immune system's not going to go after it. And it's actually the same thing under the coat, it just changed what it looked like to the immune system. That's what we call antigenic variation. To give you an example of this, the U.S. Army wanted to develop a gonorrhea vaccine. Big problem in the U.S. Army. So what they did is gonorrhea only works a disease in people. There's no animal model. So they took a piece of this gonorrhea bacterium, something called pilus on the surface, and they realized that if they shot that into rabbits, the rabbit made great antibodies against this. So they predicted, well, that should work as a vaccine. But you got to test it in people. So that was a dilemma. The U.S. Army, it's not a dilemma because there's things called U.S. Army volunteers. They vaccinated a whole bunch of U.S. Army volunteers with this. Then comes the real problem. How do you challenge with gonorrhea? Not a problem. U.S. Army, load them on a boat, send them to the Philippines where there's a lot of gonorrhea present, give them shore leave. True story. Guess what happened? Vaccine didn't work. They all got clapped. It was ampicillin sensitive, so they can all treat it. This is the problem. But the problem was the gonorrhea was changing what it looks like. Two lessons learned there. A rabbit's immune system is not the same as a human's immune system. We learn this again and again. And also that these things can change. That's why we're having difficulty building an HIV vaccine, because it's constantly changing. To make a vaccine, you've got to understand what you're dealing with. You have to know the immune system. You have to know a lot about the biology of it. But despite this, we've had many recent successes. There's new typhoid fever vaccines that work great. Haemophilus influenza causes meningitis in kids. Works really well. And in the last 10 years, this disease is basically non-existent in our population anymore. And there's whooping cough vaccines that work great, too. So they work. And when we can build them, it's wonderful. I want to put in just a couple of slides to mention something that we're starting to hear more and more about, and that's the concept of genomics. What is genomics? Genomics is basically defining the exact DNA content of a particular organism, reading its DNA sequence. You know, DNA is made up of four bases, A, C, G, and T. That's all we're made up of, and each of us has a specific code that says, I am I, and you are you. And by knowing that, that's what we call genomics. Well, if you understand and can sequence the whole genome of a pathogen, something we call sort of pathogenomics, we could then understand every single gene in a pathogen. What a powerful tool. That's what we thought. Well, we now know that. So we sequenced E. coli, lab strain E. coli, the most studied bacterium around. This was really scary, that we realized that once we knew this, we didn't know what 40% of that E. coli was actually doing. We didn't understand that. And every time we sequence a new organ, we see this again and again. We are very young in our knowledge about what these things do. Just to give you an example of the size, if you take a phone book, all the lettering on a phone book, if each one of those tiny little letters was an A, C, G, or T, it would take 100 pages of a phone book to make a bacterial genome. That's the kind of information we're dealing with, about 4 million base pairs. The human genome, the amount of sequence in each of you inside each cell, would take a stack of phone books 3 meters high. That's how much information, all those A's, C's, G's, and T's, each one of those letters in the phone book is in each one of our cells in our body. Phenomenal amount of information. Computers obviously play a major role in understanding it. Well, once we know the entire sequence of an organism, we think we can then go after, say, genes that are absolutely essential for that organ to live. That would make a good target for an antibiotic. Essential genes. And that's what's being done now. Labs are actually knocking out every single gene in these different things and seeing what the essential genes are to find new targets. The other thing is you can go on a hunt for the genes that are actually needed for the bacteria to cause disease. These things called pathogenicity islands, and they too make good targets. Well, what you can do once you know the entire genome of an organism is you can actually take a little tiny microsprayer and in a 1 centimeter slide, each one of these dots represents one of the genes in that organism. This is the tuberculosis vaccine strain. There's 4,000 dots here, and you can ask what every single gene in here is doing, either say under an infection condition or as a diagnostic. You can see what strain of TB it is, things like this. And this is where we're going with this, with actually looking what every single gene is expressed with at any given time in an organism. And that will allow us to really start to understand what's going on. Okay. So what I want to spend the last little bit about talking about is basically we learning all this, how do we use this information to come up with new ways to treat these infections? So Before we do this, we're going to talk about three different pathogens very briefly and tell you how they go about doing their dirty deeds. What is a pathogen? Well, that's a name for an organism that can cause disease. It doesn't mean it has to cause disease, but it can cause disease, has potential to cause it. And some organisms are highly virulent, meaning that if you give 10 people that organism, 9 are going to get sick. Now, others aren't nearly that virulent, say 1 out of 10 get it. This is what we call the multiplicity of infection. How many bacteria or pathogens it takes to actually get an infection. 0157 E. coli, the Hamburg disease E. coli, we're going to talk about that in a moment. It takes less than 10 bacteria to make you sick. And that is to get diarrhea. Salmonella, which we'll also talk about, takes greater than 10 million bacteria, 6 logs difference. One of the reasons is because 0157 can actually live through the stomach, the low pH, and so then most of them don't die, whereas most of the salmonella die in the stomach. Well, what pathogens have that the normal flora, those that are living on us all the time, don't have what we call virulence factors? These are sort of genetic toolkits that allow these things to actually have sort of, well, I call it sort of genetic upgrades to have pieces that they can actually then go and cause disease. Now, here's a concept to remember, and this may seem counterintuitive initially. You don't want to kill your host. A pathogen does not want to seek out and destroy every person on this world, because if it was a good pathogen, there wouldn't be a person in this world to then go and infect. It's really tough from a pathogen point of view to end up 6 feet under to then go and infect the next person. So you don't want to kill the host. Perhaps a little misery might help that allows you to cough and then spread around or have full 1 in 20 liters of diarrhea exploding into the world. That's a great rate of spread around. You don't really want to kill the host. Now, in some cases, disease is actually accidental. Bubonic plague. There's this interplay between fleas on rats. They get along actually quite well together. And the bacillus and the flea and the bacterium that cause bubonic plague can jump, the fleas bite the rat and then jump onto the next rat and they spread this round, and then they actually have a good system going. But if humans get too close to these rats, the flea leaps off the rat onto the human, bites us, injects the plague bacillus into us, we see bubonic plague. So that's actually kind of an accidental disease, and the pathogen didn't mean it that way, but we see it presenting from our point of view as a horrific disease. So let's talk about our first pathogen, E. coli. E. coli is well known as a normal flora. Everyone in this room has E. coli in your gut, and lots of them. That's normal. Some E. coli can actually cause disease. 5 kinds of E. coli cause diarrhea, 1 causes meningitis, 1 causes bladder infections. Really talented organism. 2 I want to talk about are these 2 things here, something called enteropathogenic E. coli, enterohemorrhagic E. coli, or EPEC and EHEC. These are both foodborne pathogens, meaning you acquire them from the food, and the EPEC is a major cause of pediatric diarrhea, causes several 100,000 deaths of kids per year worldwide. We don't see it too much in developed countries, major developing countries. The EHEC, which is also known as the 0157H7 E. coli, this causes a severe bloody diarrhea in people of all ages, not just kids. And unfortunately, in about 10% of the cases, goes on to cause very serious kidney disease, something called hemolytic uremic syndrome. So what do these things do, actually? Let's talk a little bit more about the hamburger disease. This is an organism that's carried in cows. The cows don't get sick. They don't get this disease. What they do, and about 10% of the cows that carry it, is they secrete this organism out, or it's in the intestine, and then when we have this tendency to put 50 cows in a blender and make hamburger, if 5 of those cows are actually contaminated, we contaminate the whole lot, it's then all thrown out. So this is where E. coli comes from. If you're a vegetarian and sitting smuggling in the audience, say, I don't eat beef, you're still in trouble because there was an outbreak of unpasteurized apple juice on the West Coast. Apples were grown in a cow orchard, went through my falling in, and that was an unfortunate outbreak. There was an outbreak in Atlanta where a kid with a dirty diaper, the diaper didn't hold, let loose in the chlorinated water, and all the other kids that were in the water then acquired it. State Fair in New York, the well was downstream of a cow pasture. So it's a big society problem. What do these things do? Here's our bacterium, here's our intestinal cell. What these bacteria do is cause this thing to sort of sprout up on the cell surface. So this is a normal cell, the bacteria live, we call these things pedestals, and they actually live up on top here and they do their thing. This is all they do. You swallow them, they go down to the intestines, and they then hang on and trigger these events in the cells to build this pedestal, and that leads to disease. Well, how do you do that? Well, you have virulence factors. Now, you don't just have one. There's no one protein that will do all those things. It's a whole collection of these things. And what these virulence factors do is each one adds at a different stage, a different function, and many of them actually work by exploiting normal host cellular processes. So let's think about this disease. You ingest your medium rare hamburger, it's a little bloody in the middle, never ever eat those. And the 10 bacteria that are in the center of that hamburger aren't killed because they're cooked. They go, they survive in the stomach, and then truck down to the intestine. First thing you have to do, from a pathogen point of view in the intestine, is hang on for dear life, because there's definitely downward movement in there, cilia is beating down, food's raining on you. So what they develop is basically grappling hooks, things called adhesins, and in this case something called a bundle forming pellus to actually latch on, and whoa, I want to hang out here for a while, and then hang on. So here we have a picture of the E. coli adhesin. So here's our bacterium. This hair-like structure here, this is something called a pilus. This is what actually allows it to then hang on to the host cell. What does that have to do with disease? Well, if you make a mutant of the bacteria that doesn't make this anymore, you then take some human volunteers, because this is only a human disease, you then feed them this, they no longer get disease. You have to be able to hang on with this sort of grappling hook in the intestine to cause disease. That's what we call a virulence factor. You need it to cause disease. Well, the next step is, once you're hanging on, what do you do next? Well, what these bacteria want to do is actually push proteins into the host cell. So here's a demo. Here's our mammalian cell. It may look like a bagel, but trust me, it's a mammalian cell. Nucleus is where my finger is. Pathogen actually has, much looks like a syringe, that is actually capable of coming up to the host cell and then squirting, in this case, my virulence factor is blue ink, into the mammalian cell. It's pushing virulence factors in. Well, what happens? Guess what? You get virulence factors in there. Many, many pathogens have these syringes that they actually come up to our cells and shovel in bacterial proteins that actually then deliver it to the host cell. And E. coli is no exception. Now, some of the pathogens include the one that causes bubonic plague. It fires in proteins. Salmonella has one, we'll talk, Salmonella actually has two, we'll talk about. And even bacteria that cause disease in plant cells, they actually have these very conserved syringes. They can push proteins into plant cells and cause disease in plant cells. And we really woke up to this fact just a few years ago, and this has become a central area in the study of diseases of how these bacteria shovel these proteins in. Well, what happens with the case of the E. coli syringe? Well, this was a couple years ago now. We made the really startling discovery that the bacteria actually harpoon in their own receptor. So they basically fire in a protein into the host cell, and then they have other proteins that can then come along, grab onto it, and then lock it down. And this is what the E. coli does. It fires in a molecule called TIR into the host cell, and then it's got this other thing called intamin that actually grabs onto it, and then it then hangs on really, really well, much better than just the initial grappling hook. And this is the first time anyone had figured out that bacteria actually push their own receptors into cells, because before that they thought they just hung on to what was already there. So these bacteria are very clever, and they use this syringe to do this. Well, here's a picture. Bluer bacteria, here's some bacteria out here, and green is an actin cytoskeleton, we'll tell you about in a second, inside the host cell, and here's the receptor that's been pushed into the cell. You can see it right out of the tip. The bacteria then grabs onto it, and then it's what we call a microbial nirvana, because it's nice and warm in the gut, lots of food, things like this, and then hangs on and then lives its life there. Well, the other thing the E. coli do is once this receptor is inside, is actually grab some more of the host cell, this thing called a cytoskeleton that makes the cell move, and actually make it build up underneath it. And this is what then provides the force to raise those bacteria up on those pedestals to then live. So let's go back to videos. Our bacterium's up here. Here's the pilus. These will be the first grappling hooks. And this is what we call the microvilli. This is what your intestinal cell surface looks like. Here's dinner up here. And this is the cell surface, and then inside the cell down here. Bacteria comes along. Grappling hooks then going to bind down. Microvilli, we know they disappear. That's response to it. Bacteria's in. There's the first step. There's the adhesion. Now it's going to stick down there, and then you're going to see the syringe appear. So let me add, this was done by a computer programmer, and he was not a biologist. So we were trying to figure out how on earth we could talk to each other, and I made the mistake of saying, well, you ever watch Star Trek? Yeah, I love Star Trek. What about Star Wars? Oh, even better. I said, well, you know what the landing pad of the Millennium Falcon looks like? Oh, yeah, no problem. So we'll draw that. So that's what you're going to see here. Bacterial surface, you're going to see the syringe coming down here. This is a protein we now know. It then shovels in two more proteins in here. Then it's going to harpoon in the receptor. You're going to see this red receptor become fired down through this tube, through the syringe. There's a modification. You'll see these blue dots appear. We know what that is. Then we know that that syringe tip actually shrinks down and drags the bacteria down onto contact the host cell. Let me just stop this here. So this is then going to shrink, and then this protein, which we know TIR, is then going to bind to intamin, and then we're going to have lockdown. Star Wars. Now on the inside, it then recruits some other proteins, and that's when this actin comes in. It's going to look like a string of pearls coming in. This is exploiting a normal host cell function. It's then going to start to form a force on the bacteria, start to push it up, and we'll then start to see it raise up. If this doesn't want to make you become a microbiologist, I don't know what will. This actually happens. At least we see pictures of this. I still have to figure out how to put a soundtrack to this. I want 2001 Space Odyssey here. That's it. That's how it does it. That's what we see. If you go into a child and take a biopsy of the infected tissue, you're going to see exactly this, except it's in black and white. So that's E. coli. That's how Hamburger disease works. Now, we worked all that out in the lab in tissue culture cells. You asked the question, well, does that actually occur in real disease? As far as we can tell, the answer is yes. This is what you see in a rabbit. It is infected with E. coli. This is a normal rabbit intestine. And over here, you see all the bacteria, and they're on all these pedestals. We've cut a cross-section through here, so that's what each of these dots are. This is the cell surface, obviously in distress and with lots of pedestals on it. If you make a mutant in that syringe or in the ink that goes into the syringe, then the bacteria can still hook, it's still got adhesins, but it cannot rearrange those fingers, those microvilli. It's stuck up there. It got through the first stage, but it couldn't finish it. These bacteria cause no disease whatsoever. They're completely avirulent, and they then get flushed out, and the rabbits appear normal. So it does occur in diseases. Well, knowing this, how do we actually go after these and think about therapeutics? Well, obviously, that syringe would be a great thing to plug up, and that's one of the things we're working on, because you could block many different diseases with it. And a neat concept is that instead of killing the bacteria, you're actually just sort of blocking it, so maybe we wouldn't select for the resistance. The other way we're doing now is vaccinating with these molecules, both, and in the spring we're going to try a major cattle trial to see if we can't actually prevent these molecules so the cattle won't carry this organism anymore. And using those kinds of knowledge, we're now trying to see if we can't actually make this work and come up with a therapeutic. Just going to talk briefly, very briefly, about two more diseases. One is Salmonella. We all know Salmonella causes typhoid fever, also causes gastroenteritis. Won't kill you. You may wish like you were dead, but nausea, vomiting, bloody diarrhea. Antibiotic resistance is through the roof, both with all these different Salmonellas. And one of the models we use in the lab is this typhoid fever in mice with the Salmonella. Well, knowing the E. coli story, you're going to know a lot more about how Salmonella does it. It too has to stick in the gut because it's a gut disease, goes through the stomach. It has adhesins, has at least six of these things and probably more to be discovered. It's probably not visible. There's actually a hair-like structure between this bacteria and the intestinal cell surface. But Salmonella is really clever, even more clever than E. coli. It doesn't want to live on the outside. It says, I'm going into that cell. It's warm in there, things like that. So it actually is what we call an intracellular pathogen, and it wants to get into the cell. So it whips out its handy syringe, fires in all these different things into the host cell, and instead of building a pedestal, causes the host cell to come up, grab that bacteria, embrace it, and yank it into the cell. Bacteria then inside the cell, and they then are able to grow in here. If you're a pathogen, your number one objective is to increase in number. If you don't increase in number, you're not going to then spread and cause disease. So they grow in here, they increase in number, and they sprout some of these very fancy little filaments we'll see in the video in a second, and these are all associated with the bacteria growing in the cell. So let's go have a look at Salmonella on the video. Now Salmonella is motile, it's called something called flagella, so it really moves fast. So hang on, because here we go. Yeehaw! Okay, bacterium, epithelial cell surface, then it's going to slam down on the surface. Boom. Okay, so it's on the surface now. It's got one of those syringes, just like E. coli. It's going to pour proteins into the cell. And you see this hail of proteins going into the cell. There they go. Forget this sequence is a blur. Okay. Now what's going to happen is because those proteins went in, the mammalian cell is going to come out, grab it, yank it in. Ask the computer programmer if you knew Little Shop of Horrors. Whatever you know. Okay, so bacteria's going inside. Now, it's kind of like if you took a piece of saran wrap and put your hand and finger against it and then pushed on it. Bacteria's actually not going to go through the membrane. It's going to cause this sort of balloon to come in and then bud off. And that's what we're going to see here. Bacteria's going to come in. Now, this green is actin, but instead of like an E. coli building pedestal, it actually provides a force to yank the bacterium in. Now, the bacterium, once they get in here, one thing cells do is they have these little sort of packets of poison they want to dump on these bacteria and kill it. Well, these bacteria say, I know that's going to happen, so I'm going to prevent that. So they whip out their second syringe, and they put in something in the sort of the saran wrap coating that then will give it a protective coating. And in a second, you'll see the syringe come out on the left-hand side of the bacterium. Here it comes. Now, this bacterium is safe. These little red poison packets, things called lysosomes, will come firing in, but ka-dink, ka-dink, can't fuse, can't kill it. It's protected from it. Bacteria continues to divide. This is what it likes to do. It's happy. It's then you're going to see at either end, it's going to start to sprout these filamentous structures that are somehow, we don't know how yet, associated with the bacterial growing. Continue to increase in number, and then they start to move and wiggle around. And the computer programmer then said, well, can't I just blow it up? I said, well, we don't know that happens yet. So you'll have to wait for the sequel for that one. So that's what Salmonella does, much like E. coli, but even more sophisticated. It goes in and lives inside cells. Well, just the last couple moments, I just wanted to. How about living inside a cell? What a great place. It's full of energy, nutrients, things like that. And I said they sort of go in this saran wrap. Then Salmonella puts this protective coating. This is how tuberculosis works. Chlamydia works. Many pathogens, they block it. Very few are macho enough to actually get those toxic poisons delivered to them. Some are. And then something called causes Q fever, very serious disease. It actually lives in here and says, rain on me, please. I know what to do with it. And it lives in here. Most bacteria choose this middle route. But there's some that said, well, I'm getting out of this saran wrap. I'm getting out right into the cytoplasm of the cell. That's where I can do everything. And we break this out. And that takes me to the last organism. And that is something called Listeria. This is the organism that there's this big campaign going on in Quebec to basically ban unpasteurized cheeses. This is the one that contaminates cheese. It infects newborns, older people, causes very serious diseases in those people. But for the sake of this talk, it goes in, much like salmonella, goes into that vacuole, but then it actually has enzymes that break that apart, put it in the cytoplasm, then it actually grabs actin, and it then propels the organism around in the cell, comes cruising along, hits the cell membrane, keeps going out, and then dives into the next cell. So very sneaky, very tough to get at, because if you're taking antibiotics or, say, antibodies, once it's in here, it never comes out. Really tough to treat in that sense. Now that takes me to the last of these movies. Let's see if we can do this. Perfect. So this is a movie. Now this is not animation. This is real life. This is Listeria inside a cell. Watch this guy. Takes a sniff here. I'm out of here. These are bacteria that are moving inside the cytoplasm of a mammalian cell. Here's the nucleus, and you can see these sort of comet tails behind them, these actin tails. They're happy. This is nice. This is lots of energy, things like that. Watch this guy. He comes up to the surface. Said, no, I'm not going there. This guy comes crashing in there, out to the surface. What they do, they then go from one to the other cell, and boy, it's difficult in terms of treating it. So here we have Listeria races. You can see these things just trucking around. Having a great time in here. Okay, where are we here? Stop. Where are we going? What does the future hold? Well, we're never going to completely win the war. I would argue we're aiming for a stalemate. There will always be new pathogens coming out. Hamburger disease first arose about 1982. It wasn't really here before that. It's because it acquired these genetic factors. TB, you saw a major resurgence. We're going to see major resurgence in other pathogens. We're always going to be after on our toes. However, as you can see, we're starting to really make inroads in how these things do this. And by knowing that, we can then block it. And we can come up with new disease models. We can, say, put human genes into mice and then cause a human-only infection in those mice and then study that. And ultimately, what we're aiming for is the idea we have to come up with new therapeutics to treat these things, vaccines, antibiotics, novel, say, anti-syringe compounds, things like that. So I leave you with the thought that there's no way we can out-divide them. These things we will never catch up to in that sense. But with a lot of logic and hard work, we're hoping we can outsmart them. I want to say thank you for the, Well, anyway, there was a very cheery picture of my entire lab, and I want to say thanks to all the people in my lab, both past and present, because it's their absolutely undying enthusiasm and hard work that's made all this possible, and they're in the new frontier, and it's with them we say thank you very much, and to say I also to you, I also say thank you very much.
Sure.
I'll repeat.
All right, our speaker.
So I guess we can take questions.
We'll take questions.
Okay. I'll repeat them.
I wonder if you have any idea where the next generation of antibiotics is likely to come from.
The question is, where is the next generation of antibiotics going to come from? Well, I think the days of one drug does everything are over. We will never find these multi-broad spectrum, you know, kills everything type antibiotics. Instead, I think where it's going to come from is studying a particular organism and saying, okay, well, how do we block Staphylococcus aureus? We then know specifically how that works. We're going to then make it. So I think we're beyond the days of, we've lost those days. So it's going to be more specific. I think we're also going to see some come in, say, you know, knowing what the virulence factors are, blocking those. That's sort of thought to be a new area that we can make progress in. And then new vaccines will come online too. We are starting to understand how immunology works much better, and we're getting better at designing vaccines. So I think it's going to, there's no one cure-all that's going to come. It's going to be piecemeal. It's going to be a lot of hard work. But I think that, I mean, I don't want to leave you with that really depressed impression. We haven't lost the battle by any means. It's just that we got to wake up and make sure we fight a hard one to keep things going.
You made two statements, and I'd like you to compare them, if you please. The first, the prevalence of superbugs is increasing. Second is your last statement. We can't help divide bacterial diseases. Smart. Would you
guy paid attention to my lecture. He said I made two statements. One is that the prevalence of superbugs is increasing, and the other one is that if we can't outdivide them, we can outsmart them. Those are both true statements, I think. First of all, there's no doubt about antibiotic resistance. That is fact. We've known it for many years. The early 80s, we first saw it. We could see it coming. It's now become a major problem, and so people are finally realizing it's a problem. In typical human nature, we now panic, and then the sky is falling type things in the press all the time. Many bacteria are still susceptible to many different drugs, and we can actually successfully treat them. We are becoming much better at figuring out what they're resistant to and sensitive to then treat them. So we haven't lost the whole battle. I mean, there's still many, many drugs that work quite well. The Visa strain is very rare. That's why we work so hard. You hear they shut down the Victoria Emergency Room because of VRE. That's because they don't want VRE potentially spreading it to MRSA to give us the Visa strain. So we're becoming much smarter in that sense and learning how to control these things. The states especially is becoming very adept at living in this post-antibiotic world. And I think we've sort of gone through a phase where this whole outsmarting them, I mean, like I said, it takes 10 years to get a drug, but about 5 years ago we realized we're in real trouble. So there's been a major effort now to make new drugs, and these are now coming online. And we're sort of in this window where it doesn't seem like there's much coming. But if you look further out, there's actually many, many biotech companies that are making some really neat headway in this. So that's why I think that we will have to continue to outsmart them. Is there things that are going to cure viral infections? Viruses, as I said, are much tougher because they're more sophisticated in that they don't carry their own set of machines, they use our machines. That being said, yes, there are some very good antivirals that are coming out. We've actually been very successful in treating HIV, this triple therapy you may have heard of. We're really starting to understand how viruses work, and viruses do have their Achilles heels, and the trick is finding them. Because a virus, say an RNA virus, has to go in a cell, it has to make it into DNA first. So there's one enzyme from the RNA to the DNA that gives you a target to go after. And the whole biotechnology revolution, we've become much smarter at figuring out the structure of a protein, and then knowing that, how can we then design something that fits right in here that's going to then block it? And every year we get much smarter and much better at doing that. We're also getting much better at making just random molecules, so we have a larger assortment to test in these different things. Both vaccines and also antiviral agents. Another area is to stimulate our own immune system to better fight off these viruses. HIV people are really lacking an immune system, and there's ways now we're starting to tickle at so it actually can fight it off and then work better. So yes, for example, the virus that causes the common cold, they're actually starting to make progress in knowing how it actually binds in the nasal surface. And they're testing in clinical trials now, nasal drops and stuff that actually block its binding. So yes, it's coming.
You mentioned unpasteurized cheese as being a source of bacterial metal infection. Would the risk be just as great as other unpasteurized products such as beer?
Beer. Wait, 10 minutes, beer, right? beer actually, it has a lot of alcohol in it. And ethanol is actually a fairly toxic molecule, as I'm sure some of you know. And beer actually, it's rare you'll get bacterial contamination in beer. That being said, pasteurization is very good at killing bacteria. And so, if you can choose something pasteurized over unpasteurized, you will definitely have less live bacteria. Pasteurization, and this we can even talk about radiation and things like that, that's another wonderful way of treating food. Unfortunately, it's called, has the word radiation in it, so people tend to get hysterical about that, but it's actually very safe, and it kills bacteria. And so, yes, we were also getting much more adept at killing bacteria. In Japan, you can actually put your Visa card into an instant teller machine, it'll autoclave it before it comes out. They tend to forget that you then grab it with your grimy fingers that are just coated in microbes, but they're everywhere. But, I think we're getting better at it. The question is, what is the role of lymph in destroying bacteria? Well, when a bacteria comes in, Our first line of defense is send out these cells whose sole job is to grab a bacteria and chew it to pieces, things called macrophages. They are very adept at wandering up to bacteria, grabbing it, yanking it inside, and then chewing it up into pieces. So the lymph is really basically where these cells are, and they're actually draining to it. So when you get inflammation, you actually call in all these, you call the soldiers to the site, and all these cells come running in, they chew on bacteria, and bacteria chewing on them, and there's debris flying everywhere. But assuming the macrophages are winning, I mean, that's what pus is basically, and then the macrophage will then drain, they go into what's called the lymph, which is a way of draining in, it then goes down into the liver and the spleen and things like that, where there's further cells that can kill things further normal, under normal situations. So lymph is a normal process, it's just the way of us just recollecting these things and then clearing out the debris. Oh, are we prepared for germ warfare? Germ warfare has been here since, well, I don't know, eternity. I mean, they used to catapult plague victims into siege cities. The British would coat the blankets with smallpox and give them to the Indians. So germ warfare is certainly not new. What is new is the concept of genetic engineering, and then maybe we can go make a super bug. And some of the scary things that have come out, it now becomes apparent the Russians were engineering, they were making some of these really nasty organisms resistant to every antibiotic you'd want to treat it with. And these things do exist, and we know they did that. So that's scary. The world is really coming to the realization that it could be a problem. As you can see, I'm sidestepping because, I mean, I really don't know. I mean, The most cited example is smallpox. There is no more smallpox in the world, so we don't vaccinate people. Smallpox is a very deadly disease, yet there's still vials of it in Atlanta, Georgia, and someplace in Russia that's supposedly locked down. And the other thing is you go to the lab and you could probably build a smallpox virus, just build the DNA. If that got loose in this world, it's very scary because there's many people in this world that have never seen smallpox or even vaccinated against it. And I think there's only 200,000 vials of smallpox vaccine that currently exists. So the U.S. is currently frantically making tons and tons, trying to get this vaccine up and running. Problems there, though, is how do you test it? Because there is no more smallpox. Hopefully it'll work, but they don't know. So it's a very sobering thought, and I don't know how to address the question. There's many, many meetings on it. Scientists are aware of it, and the idea is, but no one's been able to really take a new bacteria and let's make this super bug that's just gonna kind of thing. I mean, just being a scientist, when you try and do those experiments, they don't work. Just like every other experiment seems most of the time. It's very difficult to do. And there's no way our sophistication and knowledge is, engineer this super pathogen. I don't think we could do that yet. So I guess the best thing we do is be aware, constantly be in vigilance, figure out how you treat these things, and have good therapeutics for these diseases. Because my guess is any kind of germ warfare would use a pre-existing agent we already knew. And we know what the lists are of ones that make good germ warfare. I'm more scared of a pandemic coming from somewhere and going through the world than I am germ warfare. The question is, what reason they give for giving smallpox? Well, what happens if some terrorist group did decide they had a smallpox virus and use it, got out of the jungles or wherever? Then you have to have some way of testing the vaccine. You need those live strains to do it. You need it for research. And they've been slated for destruction several times, and several times they've decided, no, we shouldn't do that. We still need it around in case. So originally in 1998, I think, was the first time that they said all smallpox, we're going to destroy these vials because there's no more. But they haven't yet for those reasons. So they want to keep them as safekeeping, so that then if they have to break them out again in case of germ warfare or something like that, or it comes out of jungles or wherever, they're there. It's a tough decision. It also raises the question is, if a smallpox would appear, I mean, we're a naive population. It would just race through things. So there's some people that wonder, as we eradicate diseases, we're now living in an age, immune system-wise, we've never lived in before. And that may have profound implications on how a disease works. So that will come along as we get rid of more and more diseases. There's a lot of people that are actually scared, say, we've never lived without these diseases. What's that going to do for us? And we don't have those answers. All right.
Does that change the DNA?
The question is, with Helicobacter, I said it causes stomach cancers. It actually causes 75% of normal stomach cancers. The question you asked is, does it change the DNA? What Helicobacter does is it goes down to your stomach wall, and just like the E. coli and the salmonella in the gut, it lives there. It actually makes some molecules that prevent the pH from being very low around it and neutralizes that acidic environment. But it agitates the stomach surface, and it basically causes inflammation. And while it gnaws away on that, you're then going to clean the inflammation. You're getting a lot of tissue damage. You're getting a lot of macrophages coming to the site and this inflammation. And it's thought this constant barrage of tissue insult as the cells try and repair then triggers mutations that eventually lead to the cancer. So we don't know how Helicobacter does, but we don't think it's as sophisticated as, say, the E. coli, where it goes in and, say, injects an oncogene into these cells that says you'd be a cancer cell. We think currently it's just due to the inflammation that we cause in fighting these things that then, in a certain fraction, leads to stomach cancer. But that's still wide open for debate, and we just don't know why you get the stomach cancers. Time frame is long-term. These inflammation lasts a long, long time. Years and years and years. Yeah, this is not, you get Helicobacter, you'll have stomach cancer tomorrow. Not at all. In at least half the world and 80% of Asia carries Helicobacter. There's actually kind of two kinds. One tends more towards the cancers, one tends more towards the ulcers. And we're just starting to figure out what the differences are between them. Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot of inflammation. I mean, I would say 10 years, yeah. I mean, I don't know this area, so I don't know, but yeah. Is there any evidence getting a cold is bad for you? I mean, like being cold isn't temperature cold? No, I mean, people have done the studies, and that's an old wives' tale. There's no correlation to standing outside and being cold and then getting a rhinovirus infection that gives you the runny nose. There is definitely correlation if your immune system's down. For example, go on a bender. Ethanol is a very strong immunodepressant. And you can usually do the math 3 days later, you'll often have a sore throat. That's because it also prevents the cilia that are busy clearing all these organisms out of you. They actually stop beating, and that's why you're more susceptible to infection. So anything you do to immunosuppress, you're putting yourself more at risk for infections. But as for getting cold and then getting a cold, I know of no evidence that says that, yes, there's a correlation. As far as I know, that's an old wives' tale. What about Ebola? Well, Ebola is an extremely highly virulent virus. And so there's a lot of scare of it, and it sort of pops out in the middle of Africa somewhere. But we've learned to control it, because the first thing we do is quarantine. And the other thing is, you know how it's passed. It's passed by body fluids. And if you don't poke your finger into another person, you know, it's not going to pass. And if you look at the case, so, I mean, we can't break the chain of infection. Same as HIV. We know HIV is transmitted. You can then prevent that. Or gonorrhea. I mean, safe sex is, you don't need penicillin if you know these things. So getting back to Ebola and what kind of a threat it poses, I mean, we know how to control it. But as we all know, I mean, it's 24 hours anywhere in this world. And we had a plane that came over from India in 1994, I think, that when there was this plague scare, and they actually made us sit in the tarmac in Richmond for 24 hours, because that's the incubation time, to make sure there wasn't anyone on there with plague. So if something was communicable very easily, ideally aerosolly, it could rip across this world in no time flat. And if you look at the 1918 flu pandemic, that's what has everyone scared, and that's why the initial hype of the Hong Kong, you know, the avian virus one, because they were scared that might be one of these new things. And that just killed people of all ages, especially picked on young, healthy people type thing, and killed, 20 million people or something like this. So if you look at human history, we've always gone like this, like this, like this, like this, and we've just sort of bounced along, except back up to 1930, we've been going like this. You do the math. I mean, it's bound to happen, and the question is, what do we do then? It's not going to be Ebola. It's going to be some aerosol go watch Dustin Hoffman and Outbreak and things like that if you want to give a clue. So, I mean, it could spread, but I think, you know, having important control measures, knowing what you're dealing with. You go through things like smallpox and things like that, and just recognizing what the diseases are plays a major role in actually recognizing them and say, oh, yes, this is Lassa virus or whatever, Lassa fever. So knowing that, you know, you tend to get complacent if you're not seeing it. So training plays a big part, too. What happens to doctors and nurses in terms of antibiotic resistance? Do they carry more resistance areas? Well, there's no doubt, for example, on the wards with healthcare workers that are dealing with MRSA and stuff, they are often carriers of that because they're exposed to it. I mean, there is some risk there, there's no doubt. And what's the question? Right.
Are potentially
selecting resistance to whatever's killing them. Yeah.
The issue with family members, people who take large amounts of antibiotics themselves build up.
It's true. I mean, individual people taking antibiotics and then resistance acquiring in them, there's no doubt about that. And anytime you misuse and abuse antibiotics, you're going to see resistance. So in all those cases are true. You do increase resistance. But if you just look at the tons and tons and tons of antibiotics we misuse in other situations, those are actually very small situations. And I think that the biggest concerns are, especially to be honest, in Asia and places like that, where you can buy any antibiotic over the counter. Pharmaceutical company, once their drug's obsolete in North America, we have to recover some of your $200 million. You can then dump it for a song and a dance in other places where they don't care, like Asia and South America and things like this. And that's standard practice. So then we select more resistance over there to other things. So it's tough.
Last call.
Cowpox eradicated. I don't know. Shane, where are you? I'm asking my wife. She's a pediatric infectious disease person. You don't know? Does anyone know the answer to that one? Any virologists in the audience? Cowpox? I don't know the answer. Smallpox is. I don't know about cowpox.
Well, thank you, Professor. You've been very generous. And I think at this point, cut off the questions. It's been a long hour and a half, but a very interesting one. I'm now going to call on Doug Kilburn, the director of the biotechnology lab, to thank our speaker.
Yes, this works better.
Thank you. That works better?
Yeah.
I won't take long here. I want to thank Brett for what I think was a very illuminating talk on the dark side of microbiology. There's a whole world of microbes out there that don't do these nasty things, and maybe we'll have another talk sometime when we can tell you about them. But it is nice to know that there are people like Brett in the front lines when we have superbugs wandering around outside somewhere. So Brett, thank you very much for an amazing, illuminating and illuminated talk.